From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Sochi, jobs numbers, Philip Seymour Hoffman is gone, and Obamacare gets a going over. On Tuesday, the Congressional Budget Office said the president's new health care law would shrink the nation's workforce by 2.5 million jobs by 2024. Lots of debate around that. The GOP's Mitch McConnell said not pretty.
The CBO report is certainly not pretty, if you're interested in creating jobs in America.
Drugstore giant CVS said no more tobacco sales in its stores come October. President and CEO Larry Merlo said it no longer fit their image.
It's a real contradiction to talk about all the things that we're doing to help people on their path to better health and at the same time sell tobacco.
And Olympic competition underway in Sochi even before the opening ceremonies. U.S. superstar snowboarder Shaun White added to a list of oh-nos when he backed out of slopestyle to focus on his halfpipe. Teammate Sage Kostenberg sized it up in Sochi.
He wants to save his body and he wants to do his best in pipe, and I want him to do best in pipe too, because I'd be stoked to see him ride his best there and instead of doing mediocre in both, you know?
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Heidi Moore of The Guardian, Bob Cusack of The Hill, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking on American jobs, Sochi, Obamacare? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from New York is Heidi Moore, U.S. Finance and Economics Editor for The Guardian. Heidi Moore, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
It's good to be back here. Thank you.
And in Washington, Bob Cusack joins us, managing editor of The Hill, the Washington daily paper written for and about Congress. Bob Cusack, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Heidi, and Bob.
Heidi, let's go straight to these latest jobs numbers. 113,000 jobs in January. People had hoped for, projected a lot more. What's it say?
Well, it tells us that the economy is still struggling. And very specifically, it tells us that we're far away from what we need to be in a recovery. So when economists talk about truly being in a strong recovery, we would need to create about 200,000 jobs a month. And right now we're at 113. A few months ago, we were at only 74. So these numbers are telling us that we are not accomplishing our goals as a country in terms of restoring jobs. And very specifically, you have to look at the populations who are not working, and those tend to be older men and older women. In fact, one of the biggest populations that's leaving the workforce is women between 45 and 54. So that's before retirement age, but it's still older women who are more likely to be pushed out. And so those are all things that we are not really paying a lot of policy attention to.
But right people now. Had been thinking, what, maybe 170, 80,000 jobs this time out, and not. What's the explanation you're hearing for that, Heidi? Is there one?
There are a few. One is that the economy is just incredibly weak and we haven't taken any policy responses and companies are hoarding money rather than hiring. So those are the big general issues. But also a lot of people will tell you that the jobs numbers are bad this month because of the polar vortex or the bad weather we've had. Don't believe that, because one of the biggest growths in jobs came surprisingly in manufacturing and in construction. And those are jobs that happen generally outside. So if you're seeing the one bright spot in outside jobs, it's not the weather. So that's one thing we can discard.
Bob Cusack, the unemployment rate down from 6.7 to 6.6%, which ought to be good, except that we know that that's because so many people are leaving the workforce discouraged, as Heidi says. We had Larry Summers on yesterday, former Treasury Secretary, on this show saying we've got a secular stagnation here. We need a whole lot of government spending to pump things back up, get this economy going, or we're going to be in a rut for a long, long time. You cover Congress. Is anybody talking there now about doing anything substantial, whether government spending or something else entirely, about these weak, weak numbers, Bob?
Not really. I mean, they're talking about unemployment benefits, and that's probably not going to pass. It hasn't passed the Democratic-led Senate. It's not going to pass, I think, that the Republican-led House. And certainly it's very frustrating for the White House, because every time they think they're making progress, you know, you have a jobs report that is not very rosy. Now, it's true that, I mean, the economy, I think, is getting better. The unemployment rate was at 10% not too long ago, but it's just not there yet. And if you look at the polls, people are not satisfied. More people are not looking for work. It's very frustrating. And it's also frustrating for Senate Democrats, because they are facing a tough election, especially with the president's approval numbers in the low 40s. So this is causing some major concern, and that's why Republicans want the focus on the president, and they want the focus on the Affordable Care Act, because they think they can win back the Senate.
Of course, we had this Congressional Budget Office report this week, nonpartisan CPO, saying that, 2024, 2.5 million people may not be in the job market who might have without Obamacare, and there was an explosion around that. Republicans went straight at it. After Tuesday, here was Republican Texas Senator John Cornyn pouncing with his criticism.
The president's own health care policy is killing full-time work and putting people in part-time work.
Well, let's get the nuance, said the head of the CBO, Douglas Elmendorf. Here he was at a conference on Wednesday, saying the new law would reduce, yes, but when it came to explaining exactly the cause of the reduction, his message was nuanced. In Washington, that can sound muddled.
I want to emphasize that that reduction is doesn't mean that that many people precisely will leave the labor, choose to leave the labor force. We think that some people will choose to work fewer hours. Other people will choose to leave the labor force.
The White House said, hey, they've got health coverage. It's a good thing. They've got choice. Here was Jason Furman, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers.
This is a choice on the part of workers. And I have no doubt that if, for example, we got rid of Social Security and Medicare, there are many 95-year-olds that would choose to work more. I don't think anyone would say that was a compelling argument to eliminate Social Security and Medicare.
Jack Beatty, this was kind of a live grenade set down in the middle of Washington this week, and it went off in all kinds of directions. How do you read what the CBO had to say, Jack, and the reactions to it?
Well, you know, the live grenade is already going off in 30-second ads on the web from Republicans against Democratic senators saying, you know, this bill is going to cost jobs. But the truth is so much more complicated. You know, in that hearing before the House Budget Committee, Doug Elmendorf said things that Republicans like. For example, one Republican asked him, is it not the case that if fewer people are participating in the labor market, the budget deficit will increase because there'll be less taxes paid? Yes, he said that is a possible harm. On the other side, Tim Ryan of Ohio, Youngstown, a Democrat, said, well, is this a bad thing, Mr. Elmendorf? Say I'm a steel worker, I'm 62, I want to retire early, I want to, you know, leave my job before I can get Medicare. I can do that now thanks to the Affordable Care Act. Is that a bad thing? No, he said, that's a good thing. So the nuances here aren't going to be represented in the 30-second ads, and Republicans are very happy about that.
You can hear the sound of digging in here to the meaning of this at a hearing on Wednesday. Douglas Elmendorf, again, the CBO director, was asked by Paul Ryan, House Budget Committee chairman, and of course, Wisconsin Republican, for some clarity on the CBO's assessment on jobs and whether it would be good or bad, Ryan asked, for economic growth.
So just to understand this, it's not that employers are laying people off. It's that people aren't working in the workforce, aren't supplying labor to the equivalent of 2.5 million jobs in 2024. And as a result, that lower workforce participation rate, that less labor supplied, lowers economic growth.
Yes, that's right.
Elmendorf saying yes, indeed. Heidi Moore, help us out here. First of all, the 2.5 million that they're talking about. What produces that? And secondly, what about how do you weigh the strength of the economy versus, I guess, workers' freedom to leave the workplace or disincentive to be in the workplace around the healthcare coverage issue?
Yeah, you know, I think that there are some convenient arguments going on here because although everyone is so outraged at what's been happening allegedly because of Obamacare, all of these are very long-term trends in the U.S. economy. We have seen a lot of people take part-time, low-paid work for years now, and it has stimulated absolutely no outrage until they could blame it on Obamacare. And so that makes me wonder about a little bit of the context and the numbers there. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we've seen is that hours worked have been rising over the past few years as well. And usually that's a good sign, because when people are working more hours, it means that they're getting to capacity. And if they're working too many hours, then employers will hire. And employers are not hiring. And that is the key issue with economic growth right now, which is that companies perceive that there is less demand in the economy. I think that that is perhaps not the right way to see it, because they're certainly making enough profits. They're just hoarding the profits, and they are not hiring people. And so when you're talking about growth, it is a far bigger issue than the very limited extent of Obamacare. And it also has a lot to do with government spending. The government austerity, the cutbacks in government spending, have done a lot to limit U.S. growth. And again, that hasn't stimulated any outrage. And so a lot of the trends that seem to have focused this week and blamed on Obamacare, I think, are taking it way out of context, because these trends have existed and no one in Congress, not Republicans and unfortunately not very many Democrats, have shown any outrage or any impulse to change policy because of it.
But Bob Cusack, on the Hill, in the ads around the country, in this midterm election season, we are almost certain now to hear job-killing Obamacare.
Absolutely. You're going to hear a lot about that CBO report all the way up until November and I think beyond. You know, it's very interesting that the Democrats who came into office in 2008, a couple of them, they rode the coattails of President Obama, and now you're seeing them distance themselves from President Obama. That's one to watch. We're seeing it, and we're going to see it more throughout the year because of his low approval ratings.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Winter Olympics open in Sochi. The march comes tonight, but the competition already on. The debt ceiling's back on Capitol Hill. Immigration reform may be done for this year. We're looking at Obamacare and jobs with Heidi Moore, U.S. Finance and Economics Editor for The Guardian, Bob Cusack, Managing Editor of The Hill, and our own Jack Beatty. A lot of people thinking, Heidi, Bob, Jack, about these jobs numbers now and in the future. Jim's calling from Spencer, Iowa. Jim, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I've got four young adults. Children, you know, none of them are working conventionally in the job market anymore, and they're all working full time. And you know, one is a stay-at-home mom that started caring for other people's children. One is working at a temp agency that doesn't show up anywhere. Another one is self-employed. Another one is working for his girlfriend remodeling her home. Mm-hmm. So, as you see, you know, all these people that I know are now working, even though they've all been laid off. I'm wondering, are we actually able to count noses accurately? I mean, we have a lot of work-at-home people online. Do we know how many people have just left the job market because they found other ways of employing themselves?
That is such an interesting question, Jim. And you've got four young adults doing that in your house. That's a lot. And Heidi, you know, zero out of four, maybe, who would be conventionally counted there. What do you think of Jim's observation?
Well, Jim, I think you nailed a key problem with the jobs numbers, which is that they are very, very inaccurate. And so probably all four of those jobs would fall into, you know, this mystery of the missing millions in the job market. There are a lot of people who have dropped out, and we have no idea why. And the reason that they are beyond the reach of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which measures the jobs numbers, is because the way that jobs numbers are measured is largely through surveys. They go, the government goes to certain businesses and then to certain households, and it asks them who's employed, and then it extrapolates that to the rest of the American population. And there are just categories that people don't fit into. And once you're not actively looking for a job or not applying for unemployment benefits, you are off the government radar. And so that is a big problem with how we measure the numbers. And it's also contributing to the mystery of why we have so many Americans unaccounted for. And it's probably also holding up the policy response in Washington.
Officially, they're on the sidelines. They're out of the workforce. Jim reminds us, well, a whole lot of them in his house, four out of four young adults, are not out of it. They're just in it in kind of funky new ways. Bill in Covesville, Virginia. Bill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I am unclear about whether these jobs lost that are due to the Obamacare provisions
projected out in 2024, this 2.5 million.
Okay. Are they going to be net losses, or are they just people who are working less hours or retiring and will subsequently be replaced by the manufacturers to pick up the slack. In the case of the latter, it's not so much that the economy is changing at all because of Obamacare. The issue would be that the rest of us who are working are paying for those people to work less.
Yeah, Bill, stand by. Bob Cusack, can you bring some clarity in there for a caller?
Yes, that is net losses, but it's not actual jobs. I'll give you an example. If there are two people that are working and you cut basically their work hours in half, both of them, that counts for one job. But in that situation, nobody has lost their job. The problem for the administration here is that because they've got a long answer for the CBO report and in politics, when you're explaining you're losing, they're saying, well, people can retire early because they can get that bridge to Medicare. But the problem is that the economy is not doing well. If the economy were doing well and people were retiring early, well, then that would be an effective argument. Here, it's not an effective argument because people are working into their 60s now, and that's only going to improve. Now, some of that's demographics, too, because we're living longer, and we don't have the retirement savings. So, but overall, that is net losses. And I think one of the big things to look for as far as the success of Obamacare is the uninsured. That's why Obamacare was passed, to attack the uninsured. And of course, millions have lost their health insurance and millions have signed up. And where is it going to be? Is it going to be a net positive? Are the millions of uninsured going to be reduced by Obamacare? That's going to be the key indicator of success or not.
I mean, there's the insurance that they'll have, which will give them the freedom not to work. Many have worked just to hang on to that insurance. Others don't want to work too much, or their insurance will become more costly. Heidi Moore, in the tape we played earlier, we heard Paul Ryan going at this issue of economic growth and, you know, workforce participation. And Doug Elmendorf at the CBO saying, well, yes, this would mean lower economic growth. So to our caller's question, Heidi, is this fewer people working, a greater burden on those who are working, and a net economic loss?
I think it's kind of hard to say that. One of the things that we have to work with here is that these are projections by the CBO. And if you look at the history of projections, even over the past 10 years, they have all been wrong almost exclusively, whether it's from the CBO or anywhere else. So that's one issue to take into account. Another issue is that, I don't really think that you can believe that you are supporting those 2.5 million people because of what our previous caller talked about. Sometimes people are finding alternative methods of supporting themselves. And just because they're not in full-time work where their health care coverage can be measured doesn't mean that they're not contributing to the economy. So those are the two cautions that I'd urge there.
I want to keep moving on what's going on in Congress. Debt ceiling talk is back this week, Bob. And once again, John Boehner giving signals like, well, I want to deal with it, but I don't know how to deal with it. I've got my own party members who aren't ready to do it. Here's Boehner saying that Republicans, well, he hopes they won't let the nation default, but finding a bill that satisfies everybody, difficult.
Mother Teresa is a saint now, but, if the Congress wanted to make her a saint and attach that to the debt ceiling, we probably couldn't get 218 Republican votes.
Bob Cusack, are we back in this debt ceiling thing? Shut down, gridlock, stuck, or does the GOP work it out?
Well, I don't think we're going to have any kind of default or shutdown. John Boehner knows he has very little leverage. Last year was a complete debacle for Republicans with that ill-fated Obamacare strategy to the shutdown. John Boehner knows that's not going to work there. I think they're going to try to put down some type of marker where they would increase the debt ceiling and put in keystone language or maybe some type of Obamacare fix that, of course, is a non-starter in the Senate, non-starter for the president. And eventually we're going to have this little dance here for a while, and then eventually Republicans are going to cave, and we're going to basically increase the debt ceiling. And I think it's going to be a clean debt ceiling. Maybe there's one or two little wrinkles here or there that Democrats will say, okay, we'll agree to that. But John Boehner knows he can't herd the cats of the House Republican Conference, and his leverage is just not there.
So you think that one will go through? On the other hand, immigration reform, which just a week or 10 days ago seemed like the GOP might get behind in bits and pieces maybe, but behind, now seems off the table. John Boehner, they're looking to blame it on the president, saying, oh, he won't follow the law even if we pass it. But even before that, GOP not lining up on this one. Here's Boehner again.
There's widespread doubt about whether this administration can be trusted to enforce our laws. And it's going to be difficult to move any immigration legislation until that changes.
Well, okay. What about this one, Bob? Is this? I mean, it seemed like it was on just 5 minutes ago. Now it's off?
It's off. And House Republican leaders, they want to move immigration reform. They know that it's going to help the GOP in the long term. But I think enough Republicans said you don't need it in 2014. You need it by 2016. And remember, this House Republican conference, basically more than 90% of House Republicans voted against the DREAM Act, which is a scaled-down version of the comprehensive bill that the Senate passed. So as far as Boehner's excuse, well, it is kind of an excuse because he knows he can't get the votes, and he has said he must have a majority of House Republicans vote for any immigration bill. He's not close to getting that. But if he wanted to write the bill in a certain way, he could. He could say, well, we got to have border security first, and maybe the GAO could or some other agency could make sure independent agency making sure that happens before there any type of legalization. So he could craft the bill. He just can't get the votes.
Jack Beatty, a year ago, we had Republicans going off, you know, to figure out what happened in the elections and why they had done poorly and coming back and saying, we've got to do something on immigration. Now here it is off the table again. How do you read it, Jack?
Yes, they were reflecting on the debacle. Mitt Romney lost the Hispanic vote by 44 points. And, you know, the demographic trends were such that the Republicans were looking at a kind of doomsday machine. Either they got right with this new surge of immigration or they were going to be a minority party for the future. And always the issue was, will they be a viable presidential party? That's a party that's got to compete for that Hispanic vote. Or will they be a congressional party that, because of redistricting and other things, members are so safe they don't have to worry about you know, Hispanic voters. And in fact, if you look at these Republican districts, I don't have the exact figures, but they've become less whiter and whiter, less brown, certainly less black, and they're safe. And so the congressional people are saying, look, we don't want to be primaried. We don't want to have the Koch brothers or the Club for Growth or whoever it is come out and hit us over this. And so we're going to just shut down any change on immigration. We don't want to be accused of anything that could be called amnesty. And so there's the dilemma. I mean, maybe there'll be, I don't know what Bob would think of this, but I've heard some people say, well, the first primaries are in March. And maybe if the Republicans can get through those first primaries, I think they're in Texas without Tea Party, activists pushing out establishment candidates. Maybe that will be a signal for the rest of them. Well, okay, you can risk something for the good of your presidential party. But that's a long story.
I don't know, Jack. I mean, what I heard out of Washington this week was, hey, let's wait until the other side of the midterms. The GOP may have the Senate at that point, and then both houses of Congress and a lot more leverage on immigration and everything else. I want to turn our attention, if we can, halfway around the world nearly to Sochi, Winter Olympics getting underway there, and all kinds of tension, that wave of reporting about last-minute construction that we always get before Olympics open. But then a kind of special twist on security and fumbling, Russians complaining that the U.S. is beating up on them, talking too much about security issues. Here on Tuesday, in front of the House Intelligence Committee, Matthew Olson, director of the U.S. National Counterterrorism Center, spoke about threats of terrorism in Sochi.
We think the greater danger from a terrorist perspective is in the potential for attacks to occur outside of the actual venues for the games themselves in the area surrounding Sochi or outside of Sochi in the region. There are a number of specific threats of varying degrees of credibility that we're tracking.
And then on through the week, watch out for toothpaste tubes, and then no liquids or gels or powders in any carry-on luggage. Heidi Moore, the Russians are saying, hey, you know, you're giving us a black eye here and it's not fair. What do you say to that, Heidi?
Well, I think that there are a couple of reasons. I'm actually not going to watch the Olympics for a number of reasons related to the fact that I think the Chinese Olympics, the ones in Beijing, mm-hmm. showed a certain ruthless efficiency. And I think the Olympics sort of rewarded that, right? As long as you run things
make
well.
Make it work, NBC's happy, the TV cameras roll, and on we go.
Right, exactly. And it's unfortunate. But, you know, but the Olympics in Russia have been marked by carelessness. And that really worries people. So it's carelessness in security. It's carelessness in the construction of hotel rooms. If you've listened to a lot of journalists complaining about, you know, plumbing and all the things that are going wrong there, it's marked by carelessness towards animal rights, carelessness towards the environment. And most importantly, you know, carelessness towards, not just free speech, but towards the whole issue of placing the Olympics Olympics in a subtropical environment where the temperature is going to be 56 degrees all week. So that's not great for the Winter Olympics. Everything about this tells us that, you know, Russia has been proud to get sort of the money from the Olympics, but are they really deploying that in a sense of honor and nobility in the spirit of the Olympics? That's what people are questioning.
But you said you're not watching, Heidi. Presumably that's not because of carelessness, and Russia's going to spend a lot more than they make on these. You must not be watching for political reasons on the gay rights front.
It's partially for, it's actually for a consumer and a consumer objection for sort of political reasons. So gay rights and animal rights. I mean, one of the things that they're doing as well is rounding up dogs and killing them by the hundreds because they don't think that
strays.
The presence of those dogs, the presence of those strays are, you know, elegant enough for Western eyes. So, you know, I think that if you stand by and you watch athletes and you use your eyeballs and your money and your support to give that attention to the Olympics, meanwhile, all of that money and all of that support is being used to shame people about their identities or to silence others, I think that's a kind of a core consumer hypocrisy. Our money is a vote. And if we're watching the Olympics and, you know, kind of supporting what's going on right now, then we are voting for that kind of oppression. So, you know, it may not change the world, but that's why I'm doing it.
It's interesting. Americans are, in a way, going to be tested over this next week or 10 days as the Olympics go on by the news reports coming out. Here I've got, this is just from the Associated Press out of Russia in St. Petersburg. Russian police have arrested four gay rights activists protesting there on opening day of the Olympics. They unfurled a banner quoting the Olympic Charter's ban on any form of discrimination, quickly rounded up by police. Americans will be tested. Amy, Greenfield, Massachusetts. Amy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I think Karen's point was wonderful. And just taking this beyond the point about core consumer hypocrisy and to the days and months and years after the Olympics, you know, I think that as a world, we can all look at, you know, the concern of the sort of the absurdity of holding on to the old, tired oppressions and notice that the wave that's coming and what witnessed from the Grammys and, you know, the new young generation. And yet, at the same time, you know, while we're waiting for that change to come, and hopefully it'll happen very, you know, ramp up and so forth, you know, people are dying, right? People are being, you know, killed, executed in countries where it's illegal, that the opposition to gay rights movement in the U.S. is now given up here pretty much, but exporting it to other countries.
Are you going to watch the Winter Olympics, Amy?
I am not sure if I will or not. I love the sport. I have a family history of watching it and going to it in Lake Tahoe, actually. But the concern happening now with animal rights and gay rights and the I think the point about exporting anti-gay sentiment from people in this country is akin to how how the tobacco industry decided to export marketing cigarettes outside of the U.S.
Amy, you got a lot on the table there. We've got a break coming up. Bob Cusack, opening ceremonies tonight. I think curiosity is going to have an awful lot of people there. And once those games get started, of course, millions will watch. NBC is counting on that. Heidi may not. Others may not. But it is an interesting tension in the air around these Olympics, Bob.
No doubt about it. A lot of politics around this Olympics, whether it's gay rights, you have the threat of terrorism. A congressman the other day said, be careful what you say in Russia because you don't know who's listening. And you also have Edward Snowden in Russia. So this is going to be, I think, a compelling Olympics and hopefully a safe one.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, long time NBC host Jay Leno signed off for the second time as host of The Tonight Show, and his very first guest, Billy Crystal, came back for a musical tribute to Jay alongside Oprah Winfrey, Jack Black, and more.
I don't like goodbyes. NBC does. I don't care. I don't care for them. Well, tonight is our last show for real, and see, I don't need to get fired three times. I get the hint.
Regretfully, they tell me, but firmly they compel me to say goodbye to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jack Black.
So long, farewell, I'll be there.
The Tonight Show. If Fallon tanks, you'll be back here next year. We'll see. Philip Seymour Hoffman's sad story, found dead at 46 from heroin overdose. Brilliant actor in roles from Truman Capote to A Priest Under Fire in Doubt to here, the wildly charismatic cult leader in 2012's The Master.
I do many, many things. I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man.
Philip Seymour Hoffman gone this week at 46, and tons of snow this week. Thousands in Pennsylvania left without power. There was a bright side for Stevens Elementary in Burlington, Kentucky. Exuberant principal James Detweiler and drama teacher Chad Cadell called school off with a song.
We just got a call, breaking news. School is closed, sorry parents for another day. Watch out for frostbiting, very, very frightening. School is canceled,
school is canceled,
school is canceled,
school is canceled,
because it's cold.
Okay, there's some kind of school spirit. We're looking at a week in the news. Sochi opens, the debt ceiling's back, GOP cold feet on immigration, Obamacare and jobs. Heidi Moore is with us, U.S. Finance and Economics Editor for The Guardian. Bob Cusack, Managing Editor of The Hill. Jack Beatty is here. Before we leave Sochi and Russia, we've got calls on that, but also this funny audio tape that came out this week, posted anonymously on YouTube. It appeared to capture a telephone call between U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, talking about the crisis in Ukraine, which has gone on for weeks now. They seem to be supporting opposition to Ukraine's pro-Moscow president, Viktor Yanukovych, and were profanely dismissive of the European Union. Here's some of that call.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it. And, you know, the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
Bleep the EU, says the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and the U.S. leaning toward the opposition. The Russian officials reposted that audio on Twitter on Thursday. State Department spokesman said she had no information about who posted it, but criticized Moscow for promoting it. I mean, Jack, here is apparently Russia listening in. We hear all about the NSA listening in, but here may be Russia. And what they hear is just candid diplomat talk behind the scenes. They don't think EU is going to do anything, but they favor the dissidents, I guess, in the Ukraine. Is this a problem, Jack?
Well, it's redolent of the Cold War, isn't it? This kind of thing. And according to today's Times, the secret tape is being pointed to by a Kremlin advisor as an he accused the U.S. funding and arming the protesters in Kiev and seeming to threaten Russian intervention, as if they're setting up a kind of, that's something like what happened in 1968, isn't it, in Czechoslovakia, provocation, and we have to come in and take over. Very, very sort of Cold War rhetoric here.
Of course, Russians say it's the U.S. getting involved in provoking,
right,
and pushing things around, but sure, a lot of genuine unhappiness on those streets in Ukraine. You don't stick out there in below zero weather all night long under batons and shields if you don't mean it.
That's for sure. And the Times also has a photograph of a poor fellow who claims he was crucified. He was a protester. He was leading them. And he was taken out in the country. And his hands, he says, were nailed to a door and cut off part of his ear. And he said, and the people who were doing it, why, they had Russian voices. And Putin's apt or something bad out there.
Well, we'll see. Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I would like my comments about Olympics, especially about coverage, because I'm very excited. I'm Russian, and
yes,
I used to do sports a lot. You know, it's great. I tell you, sports is much more. I mean, so anyway, my point. You just looks like you are not happy. I mean your government. When people's happy, join. You're not happy. It's what I feel. You know, and I give you more example. Okay, 1980. Big boycott, Moscow Olympic Games, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And you said reason, because you guys fight in war, so we will boycott you. So how about 1968? Was
you mean going way back to when Jimmy Carter boycotted the Moscow Games? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to make comparison about, so if it's right, let's say if it's right way, if you fight war, you not be an Olympic. So, but how about 1968 in Grenoble, when you guys, America was fighting bloody war in Vietnam, and you was winning medals, stadium, on the podium.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's long history. I say you should stop blame. You should enjoy the games. That's all. And if you have something to say, say after.
Peter, we've got it. And, of course, here now the U.S. is in Afghanistan. Games going on in Sochi. Bob Cusack, what about the Russian lament that there's a kind of poisoning of the games going on by the world community?
Yeah, well, there's always going to be politics with these Olympics, and this has been no exception. We were asking a few months ago whether the whole, when the Snowden news broke, whether America should consider a boycott, especially after Russia was giving him protection. Senator Graham, certainly from South Carolina, suggested maybe that's an option, but that was quickly shot down by President Obama and others. So, you know, it is something, and it's sports is great, and it has a way of overcoming politics. But I don't know if these Sochi games are going to we're going to be saying that at the end of it, because there's so much politics and so much unrest. Nancy Pelosi saying she wishes that the Olympics weren't in Russia because of the gay rights issues. So I think there's going to be a few Americans that won't be tuning in.
A lot of Olympic politics, some big politics. Japan's leader will be there. Of course, he's looking for allies these days with China, and their tensions with China. Willem in Colfax, Wisconsin. Willem, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I saw a program on one of the networks where a reporter went there with his computer and his smartphone. They went to a cafe. He used his smartphone, and within literally seconds, they were downloading everything on his smartphone. So, in the Soviet Union, so I was thinking, with everyone having these devices, that there's a risk for, and people using them for like banking and accessing money and all this sort of stuff. How can this be secure? How can people, you know, with what happened with Target and other stores?
Yeah, Willem, I saw that report on NBC. It was remarkable, taking in brand new, squeaky clean computers and cell phones, and within seconds or a couple of minutes, hacked in Russia. Heidi Moore, you're not even watching, but if you were there, would you be plugging in your laptop, turning it on, opening up your smartphone?
I think it pays to be careful whenever you're traveling, and you know, there's a reason that a lot of foreign leaders aren't going to the Olympics besides principles. One of them is, of course, that they can't guarantee that they won't be surveilled, and a Russian Olympic official this week actually let on that perhaps there are cameras in the showers, in the hotels, before, you know, quickly walking back those comments. He said that, you know, they had seen on cameras that people were leaving their showers on, which is really alarming. But I will say about that NBC report, unfortunately, for our purposes, it's been debunked. And so, you know, there are some stories that you can find that, you know, challenge that report and say that it wasn't true.
Wow.
So, yeah. So
that's
it's
a
good
pretty
to
big
have,
black
you know,
eye, given the prominence they gave it, if that's true. Wow. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the thing is, a lot of these things do take investigation, so we should give it all the benefit of the doubt. But, you know, right now there has been a counterpoint to the truth of that. But it does pay to be careful, particularly, you know, when overseas in a country where you can't speak the language. You know, what happened here with Target, where we are all informed about banking, you know, could obviously happen anywhere else just as easily.
Jack Beatty, talk about a Cold War feeling. You know, a big claim of some nefarious doings, and then, oh, well, maybe there weren't those nefarious doings. Sheldon, Columbia, South Carolina. Sheldon, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Go Seahawks. Thanks, CVS, for no cigarettes. What I want to do is, you know, talk about Sochi. You know,
yeah.
I hope the Jamaican bobsled team gets in there. And I want to send a shout-out to Sean White, because my sport is snowboarding.
All right.
And I know, you know, politics can mix into the Olympics and all, mm-hmm. but like, you know, North Korea, you know, if they're involved, and I don't know if they are and all, you know, it's a lot of countries that may be hostile to different, you know, different nations, you know, this and that and all. But I look at it, you know, I'm going to watch it because, you know, Sean White and the snowboarders, you know, my little one, you know, she watched it last night. She said, you know, Daddy recorded for me and everything. I said, okay. But snowboarding comes from my childhood, because back in the day, we were going down on trash can lids when I was at Pease Air Force Base in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, in New England. And, you know, all kind of different, you know, inventive kind of things like that.
Hey, Sheldon, let me ask you. You're a snowboarder. Sean White backed out of slope style. Do you think he was right to do that? He said,
yes, yes.
Too dangerous?
It's real dangerous. Because, matter of fact, Sean White has a friend that got seriously, I mean, horrifically injured. And even to this day,
he hasn't fully recovered. I mean, he, of course, he could snowboard, but any kind of abrasion, if he was to do the slope style and hit the wrong way, he could basically kill himself.
Save it for the half pipe. Sheldon, I appreciate your call. We hear you're into it. I'm pretty sure you're going to be watching already. I've got a few more things I've got to hit here. I appreciate your call, Sheldon. Let's go. A couple other big business stories. CVS getting out of selling tobacco. That turned a lot of heads. Here was CVS CEO Larry Merlo telling CVS, giving some background to that decision.
My father was a smoker and died of cancer at a young age. It continues to be a leading cause of illness and death in our country.
All right. Heidi Moore, you've written about this, said this is going to win them props from anti-tobacco folks. But it's not just philanthropy or his father's history, perhaps, at work here, you said, Heidi.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of like thermodynamics. If you get rid of money, you have to find it somewhere else, in the same way that if you get rid of energy, you have to find it somewhere else. So CVS has – this is obviously a move that has been – that a lot of people will greet. It's a very smart move. But there are other ways that CVS is getting its profits. And
losing $2 billion, they've said this week. So what makes up for that?
Well, what will make up for it? First of all, $2 billion is a very small portion of CVS's overall profits of $200 billion. But also, they are firming up their healthcare business. And so they are making a lot more money from things called minute clinics, where people are going into CVS to get medical advice, or having their pharmacists advise people. They've had 4 million of those interventions last year. And more importantly, CVS wants to be a big contract partner with Obamacare and the public exchanges. And Obamacare, as you know, is very much against smoking. It has raised premiums on smokers by nearly 50%. And so by not approving of smoking and taking that strong stance, CVS really strengthens its position to talk to the public exchanges and the government about Obamacare.
What about Microsoft? They got a new leader there, Satya Nadella. He's talking about innovation in every other breath. But Bill Gates is going to be around. Microsoft has lost a lot of its luster in recent years. Do they get on an innovation train, a better curve with their new chief, Heidi?
Yeah, that's what they need. This new CEO is, he's very cool. He's very techie. He seems Silicon Valley, even though Microsoft is in Washington. But he has a really tough job. So the people who put him in the job, Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer, the previous CEOs, are still sitting on the company's board. And if he wants to improve Microsoft, he has to cut ties with them. That's what Wall Street wants. Wall Street wants Microsoft to change direction, to be more innovative, to return more money to the people who own its stock. And to do that, he has to distance himself from the people who have helped him for 22 years. It's almost like a novel, what's happening with Microsoft, and very much worth watching.
I want to meditate on Philip Seymour Hoffman and his death this week for just a minute. Great, great actor. Maybe the greatest of his generation, many are saying this week. Gone with a needle stuck in his arm, and it just hurt. Here's a little bit of a conversation he had with philosopher Simon Critchley. This was at the Rubin Museum of Art in 2012. And Philip Seymour Hoffman talking about having recently seen a production of Ivanov, Chekhov's 1887 drama, and explaining here how much of himself he saw in the main Chekhov character.
That play is so much about somebody who's saying, I'm not going to be happy, and I'm going to make you miserable, and I can't seem to get out of this, and and I'm looking at this guy who's kind of my age, who's the same similar problems, and I was sitting there looking, going, oh, God, and realizing I was thinking the same way that this character was thinking, and how it is still a pursuit of happiness. It is still him struggling to try to find a way out, but it just keeps circling back on itself constantly. The same thought, the same idea, the same action. Just he can't seem to get out of it.
And now, Jack, this great actor gone. And what a sad way to go. What a sad loss, Jack.
Oh, terrible loss. That very vulnerability and almost naked expression of his own problems in that interview, that's what made him a great actor. He put that in there, especially in his three roles for P.T. Anderson. In Magnolia, he played a male nurse treating Jason Robards in his last days with great compassion and feeling. We had The Master on, where he plays this charismatic, sinister cult leader, and of course in Magnolia, in Boogie Nights, he plays a closeted gay man who's just in love with this pornographic actor, and who suddenly just reaches out and kisses him and holds him, and of course it's all wrong. It's all wrong, and the actors, the character says, I don't want this. I don't want this. And he says, I can't do anything right. I mean, any human being watching any of those performances would see dimensions of the human experience rendered in vivid and heart-stopping terms.
We will miss Philip Seymour Hoffman. And thank you, Jack, for bringing him so vividly to mind there. Thanks for that tape. We can hear once again just how thoughtful he was. Sound of a More Innocent Age, time perhaps behind us right here. 50 years ago this weekend, the Beatles first appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, kicking off the British invasion in music. You'll hear about that all weekend long. I want to hold your hand. Heidi Moore with The Guardian, U.S. Finance and Economics Editor there, joining us today from New York. Thank you so much for being here, Heidi.
Thank you.
Bob Cusack, Managing Editor at The Hill. Great to have you with us, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
Heidi, Jack, Tom, I really enjoyed it.
And Jack, off we go with the Beatles. Remember when, Jack? Here we go. Thanks for joining us. Listeners, Twitter handle, mine, Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Check it out. Great to have you with us. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.